Case number 07-1419 et al. The Raymond P. Kravis Center for the Performing Arts Incorporated Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Roberts for the petitioner, Mr. Side for the respondent.
Morning.
May it please the court. The board does not contend in this case that there is any evidence in the record that a majority of Kravis's employees in an appropriate unit ever designated or selected Local 623 as their collective bargaining representative. And the union business agent, John Dermody, conceded at the ALJ hearing that there was never any voluntary recognition agreement entered into between Kravis and Local 623.
I'm interested you're raising this argument since there was a petition for an election, but then your client took action that held up that action. And now we're at the posture where we're looking at the board's general approach that you can have an inference of majority status under these types of circumstances.
I'm not sure I followed that, but the petition that was filed by the union was filed after Kravis had withdrawn recognition, and they filed it in a larger unit than what they previously claimed that was being covered under the collective bargaining agreement. Our position, though, is that this was not a 9A union. It never was. It's not just that it was not a 9A union at inception. It never became a 9A union because there was never any designation or selection. The board's only, the sole basis in the record, or the sole basis relied upon by the board to find 9A status were the two bargaining agreements that were entered into. But neither of those agreements contained any language granting the union exclusive recognition as an exclusive bargaining representative. There's nothing in there that contains a union security clause. And so what the board has done is applied a presumption of majority status based on a presumption of regularity. But the problem is that the Shamrock Dairy, which is the case that apparently originated this theory, the Shamrock Dairy case, that the presumption arises only if there's a grant of exclusive bargaining rights, exclusive representation. So unless the board can show that we granted Local 623 exclusive representation rights, then the whole underpinning for Shamrock Dairy presumption falls, and there's concededly no other evidence in the record that the employees ever designated the union as their bargaining representative. I think the board's position appears to be that it has to be a majority-based relationship because we're not a construction industry employer and therefore 8F of the Act doesn't apply, but the Supreme Court's decisions in Consolidated Edison and even in the garment workers case clearly indicate that you can have minority labor agreements. They're perfectly lawful as long as they don't grant exclusive recognition to the union and as long as they don't contain a union security clause, because Section 8A3 is subject to, or the proviso on union security clauses is subject to Section 9A. Our agreement had none of that.
What if we, reading your agreement de novo, think that it is exclusive? Then what? What if we accept the NLRB's reading of the agreement?
If you were to accept their reading of the agreement, then we would take the position that the presumption is inconsistent with Lady Garments Workers Union and with Nova Plumbing, and that presumption is basically saying that the parties can usurp the role of the employees and designate a union on their behalf. And nothing in the Act gives the employer and the union the right to select a bargaining representative for the employees. So we would argue that even if you interpret the agreements as granting, as us intending to grant exclusive representation rights, we can't trump the Section 7 rights of employees to select or not.
Is there a six-month period, though, that kicks in then?
Is there what?
Six-month period?
Well, I think the 10B period that the board relies upon is a red herring because that if 10B applies to a defense, if it applies to a defense, it can only apply if the sole basis for our defense is that the inception of the relationship was unlawful. We argue exactly the opposite. We argue that it was a lawful relationship, albeit a voluntary relationship. Plus, our position is not that the.
But assume we say that's not true. That is, assume we read this as we're moving along from the question. Assume we read this as an exclusive clause.
Well, but what I'm saying is that I'm assuming that you're reading it as an exclusive. If you don't read it as an exclusive representation clause, then I think the entire underpinning of the.
Assume we do.
If you do read it as an exclusive representation agreement.
You entered into an exclusive representation clause.
Okay.
Then, your position is that that would have been unlawful.
Yes, it would have been unlawful. But our position now is not that is the reason for not finding 9A status, but at no point thereafter did the union ever establish majority status. So even
the presumption, the cases about the presumption all say you can't keep asking this question over and over again. You have the presumption during the period of the contract and then during the renegotiation period.
Well, I think the case is the Bryan manufacturing.
6 months.
The local 1424 decision, the Supreme Court Bryan manufacturing decision, was a case where the union's the sole objection or the sole challenge to the union security and exclusive representation clauses was the lack of majority status at the signing of the agreement. The union thereafter acquired majority status by virtue of the union security clause. So when it was challenged 10 months later, the only basis for overturning the enforcement of those provisions was that it was unlawful in the beginning. Nothing in 10B says that because there happened to have been an unfair labor practice back in 1992 that the union magically becomes a 9A union unless if it has never acquired majority status. In all the cases, the cases are all that find that are where the union subsequently acquires majority status and the only basis for challenging it was the initial unlawful recognition. What we're saying is that it doesn't matter whether the initial recognition was unlawful because the union at no point in time in the 15 years or the 10 years or 8 years of their relationship established that they represented the majority of the union.
How is this different from the Judge Edith Jones decision in the Strand case?
I think, for one thing, in that case, they specifically recognized the union, and that demonstrates.
Well, I'm assuming that, again, I want you to assume.
Okay, assuming that that's the case, then we would argue that that decision is inconsistent with this court's decision in Nova Plumbing, which relies on lady garment workers.
Judge Jones, distinguishes our Nova Plumbing case, but in Nova Plumbing, it expressly says that we're going to decide this narrowly based on the fact of 8F being present. But so your answer to Judge Jones's opinion is just wrong. That's it? That's right.
Well, not just wrong. I think that's one answer to it. I think that in that caveat, I think we're distinguishable for the reason I've said, but if you find that it was an exclusive representation agreement, I think that decision perhaps didn't raise the issues that we had. I don't know.
Because Strand raised exactly this argument, that the agreement doesn't show that the union represents them.
Yeah, but their argument was at the inception that it was unlawful. I can't tell from the opinion whether they ever argued that the union never thereafter acquired majority status because it's not. I don't think those decisions mean that.
What she says is Strand's argument flatly contradicts the principle that except in the construction industry, a union is entitled to a presumption of majority support during and after the contract period. That's what she says.
Well,
that is what all those, cases running back for an awfully long time say that.
Well, there's a presumption of majority status, but the presumption is rebuttable, and the burden of proving 9A status remains on the general counsel.
The presumption doesn't that mean that it has to be overcome by evidence on the other side. Otherwise, a presumption is meaningless. What's the meaning of a presumption if it doesn't mean that someone in your position has to offer evidence to the contrary?
Well, we did offer. The evidence is that they never established it. So there was evidence in the record that
That's
they never.
That's the same thing as saying there's no presumption. You need some evidence the other way.
Okay, but I want to move on because of my time's running out. But my position on that would be that I think that decision is inconsistent with Nova Plumbing. But I would also say that even if the union, and I don't want to lose sight of this, even if the union, you find that the union was a 9A union, we still have the good faith uncertainty issue. And that's a state of mind. That's not a presumption.
Good faith uncertainty doesn't go back to the time of the initial formation. It goes to the time later.
Yeah, and the point is, though, that throughout the relationship and the Dayton Motel case we cite in our reply brief and even the Pick Mountain Laurel case cited by the board recognizes that you can look at the whole state of the relationship in determining whether there was a good faith uncertainty of majority status. And our point is that we knew that there was never any showing of majority status. And the presumption, even if the presumption applies that the relationship continues, the standard is good faith uncertainty. In Allentown Mac, one of the specific definitions that the Supreme Court references was a fluctuation of mind arising from a defect of evidence or knowledge. Well, that's exactly what we have here, is that we knew that they had never established, so by definition, we were uncertain. The board wants us to have to prove an actual loss of majority status, but that's not the standard that was applicable at the time this case was decided. It was simply a good faith uncertainty. I would like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, unless there's other questions at this time.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Desai for the Labor Board. The company here, as it was building its center, it contacted the union for assistance in helping to provide skilled union workers. Upon opening the center, the parties entered into two bargaining agreements that contain many of the provisions that one would expect in a normal bargaining agreement. The company followed provisions as if this was an agreement that was covered under the Act when it promptly contacted the mediation service after the expiration of the first contract. And now, 8 years later, when it suddenly determines that the union isn't beneficial to it, it wants to simply walk away. And it's done so, however, under arguments that essentially recognize that this is an agreement that's covered under the Act. Before the administrative law judge, it made a statutory argument that this was an 8F pre-hire agreement. The judge rejected that argument that, being in a non-construction industry, it could not have entered into an 8F agreement. Before the board, it again made a statutory argument. It specifically recognized in its brief in support of the exceptions that ordinarily it would be time barred under Section 10B from challenging the union's majority status. But it tried to get around it, claiming that certain union actions had essentially restarted the 10B period. That was an argument that the board rejected, and it has not been raised before this court. And now as it gets to this court, it again makes arguments that continue to suggest that this was somehow an 8F agreement. But again, it's recognized that there can't be an 8F agreement here. And it's also tried to suggest that this was a members-only agreement, which on its face it can't be, because member-only agreements, to the extent that they are lawful, only apply to union members. And here we have a situation where the bargaining agreement includes, as a right to work state in Florida, it obviously includes people who are not union members. And as far as there being no specific showing, the company recognized in its own reply brief at page 5 that there's no requirement that a contract contains a specific reference to majority support, that there doesn't need to be any specific evidence of verification. It's simply that there simply needs to be some evidence that a bargaining relationship was envisioned. And here there is clearly a bargaining relationship that was envisioned that went on for 8 years until the company suddenly determined that it didn't want the union and basically the hassles that a union brought with it. And unless this court has any questions, the board would simply ask that the court enforce its order.
Thank you. Yes, counsel for petitioner.
I think that there's, you know, that you can't lose sight of the fact that, you know, we're talking about whether the union was entitled to a 9A status. I mean, and when there's no evidence in the record that there was ever any designation or selection by the employees, then it seems that that is usurping the role of the employees in the unit. And I think that the board's position is based on the fallacy that this was an exclusive representation agreement. And the cases are clear that you can have minority labor agreements, and there's no language in that agreement or any of those agreements that purports to recognize the union as an exclusive bargaining representative. Exclusive recognition clauses are standard in most of these kind of agreements. The Strand case included one that was very specific. We don't have that kind of language in this case. So they're applying a presumption in a situation where the premise of the presumption is not there. And in essence, they're saying that we're going to find 9A status simply really out of nothing. I mean, you know, or the fact, other than the fact that the parties had a relationship of some kind for 8 years and nobody challenged it within that time period. I think that that's a dangerous kind of precedent to say, you know, and tends to undermine the Supreme Court's decisions that there can be other kinds of agreements. Even the Lyon Dry Goods case that was a 301 action, I believe, they found that even minority agreements are recognizable and enforceable. So, I mean, and I go back to these agreements, we don't challenge the lawfulness of them. They were lawful, but they were voluntary. The union could have proceeded to an election in 2001, you know, after they filed their petition. There was nothing to prevent that. And I think that we're asking the court to look at these agreements to interpret them de novo, because the board's not entitled to any deference in terms of its interpretation of the agreement. So this is not a matter of simply deferring to the board's judgment. It's a question of looking at those agreements and also looking at if there is ambiguity in it, the extrinsic evidence I would cite to is, I mean, the arbitrator Goldstein's opinion that reflects that this agreement did not cover non-referred workers and that the company had the right to have non-referred workers. So I think that the entire thrust of that agreement was that it was a hiring hall relationship. And those are not inherently unlawful, even in a minority situation when there's not a grant of exclusive recognition. And so you have what was essentially a hiring hall relationship where the union was a source of skilled labor, and that's what the relationship was, but that doesn't automatically mean that it gets all the benefits of 9A status or that there was any burden to challenge the relationship when it was inherently lawful, you know, in its own right. So we would ask that you look carefully at this agreement and at the fact that there was no exclusive recognition, and the fact that there was no proof in the record of ever, not just at the inception, because 10B would only apply if that were the sole basis for objecting to it. And, you know, what we're saying is that at no point in time did the general counsel come forward with any evidence of majority status. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.